Last month, you may remember, there was a bold attack on the Syrian capital of Damascus when rebels bombed intelligence headquarters and took out four high-ranking officials. Over the next few days after that attack, rebels stormed into the city of Aleppo. New Yorker staff writer John Lee Anderson was in Aleppo at that time. He's out now, and he joins us this morning from London. John Lee Anderson, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
John, we're talking about a very specific set of circumstances here in Syria. It took us a couple of months, many months actually, to get to the point where this was called a civil war. But as you point out in your piece in The New Yorker, we're not just talking about one side against another in Syria. We're talking about a mosaic of different religious and ethnic groups, and they've all entered the fray in one way or another at this point. Talk about what you saw in Aleppo and how it illustrates some of that confusion.
Absolutely. Well, I need to go no further than the little town of Azaz, about 30 miles north of Aleppo, which has traditionally been a gateway to that city since time immemorial. Battles were fought there 1,000 years ago, and they're continuing to be fought today. That small town of 35,000 people, very near the Turkish border, was seized at the same time that the rebels surged into Aleppo, and as they had just done in Damascus. I arrived a day or two after they had overrun the security headquarters where the regime had been hunkered down, and then they had chased them out of town. There were three different militias in control of that town. I met with two of the militia leaders. One, a former border smuggler, Abu Ibrahim, wanted me to see his 11 Lebanese hostages and made a play for Western support to him, and told me he was receiving money from the government of Qatar, one of the sponsors of the rebellion. Across town, a young man called Abu Anas, who greeted me with a golden sword, a black flag behind him, and his hand on the Holy Quran, who told me that he had been trained by men who had fought the Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan and hoped for an Islamic State of Syria. These men are allied with one another at the moment to oust the regime of Bashar al-Assad. But one suspects that in the future they may have some differences to iron out.
Well, one of the things that your story illustrates really, really clearly as you present these characters is that there's a certain aspect here in Syria of opportunism, not just of rebels being motivated by the cause of removing al-Assad or by the cause of democracy or whatever form of government we might be looking at in the future, but people moving into positions because they can, because the opportunity is there, and because they're in a position to maybe gain some influence, gain some power. Is that what you witnessed?
Yes. I mean, one should not downplay the civic-minded people who provide the grassroots support for the rebellion, who hold town council meetings to try to ascertain people's needs, beliefs, suspicions, fears, hopes for the future. These are ongoing. And in some cases, they provide an important contention line with hotheads within the armed movement that is fighting the regime and so forth. But there is, of course, a certain amount of opportunism. You see it in every war. In the case of northern Syria and other parts of the country, you have a situation where the government's authority has effectively imploded. There is now a mosaic of towns and villages around Aleppo, where I was, which are effectively in the hands that have been liberated, quote-unquote, from the regime. There remain armed bases in the vicinity where the regime forces have hunkered down. They fly gunships out of them, and they fire howitzers from them at some of these very same surrounding towns and villages. But the power now is in the hands of armed men, in some cases from those same towns and villages, in some cases from outside. And they have a multiplicity of reasons for doing what they're doing. Most, one has to take it at their word that they're doing so because they want a different sort of country in the future. They can no longer countenance the brutality of their regime. But there is no doubt that there are opportunists at work in there. And there's also adjacent sects. This is primarily a Sunni Muslim rebellion against the Shiite offshoot Alawite minority that rules the country. But there are also Kurds, Christians, Turkmen, and others in these areas. And each of them are now having to jostle with this newfound gulf in central authority and who the new authorities are, and looking for alliances and looking to cut deals and possibly to arm themselves.
John Lee Anderson, in the midst of this mosaic mayhem that you're describing inside Syria, it makes me wonder how comments like those made by President Obama yesterday, that if the regime of Bashar al-Assad mobilizes unconventional chemical weapons in any significant way, that would change the equation. Read from that, the United States would consider action in Syria. How does that statement cut against what you're seeing? Does it cut at all or just simply bounce away? What do you think the president was going for, and was it even heard by these groups that you're describing?
Well, I think it was. But I mean, I have to say that how I believe it might play out on the ground in Syria is as a kind of message to Bashar, to Assad, that, OK, we can't go that far, but we can go up to that point. Now, I've spoken with people who tell me that who are in the know, who tell me that Assad has almost hardly used his air power at all. Only the past 3 weeks have we seen the use of fighter jets. Now, one might have thought that that could have been a red line if one went back a year ago to what happened in Libya with NATO, but apparently not in Syria. Now, he has hundreds of airplanes he could still use in the skies over the country and devastate, for instance, the rebel heartlands. He seemed to be trying out a new strategy just last Thursday when he went to the very same town I described at the beginning, Azaz, and dropped a very big bomb on a civilian row of houses. That was a first. 40 civilians were killed. Many more refugees surged out. Now, the point about that was this was Assad sending a message to the rebels fighting in Aleppo, the city, that he could hit their families in their homes. Now, if I were Assad, I might well think that I could do more of that if the Americans are not going to intervene until he uses chemical weapons.
I want to talk a little bit about civilian life in the city of Aleppo, what you've seen there and then around Syria. How are people getting by right now as the violence ticks up and some of the shortages tick up?
Well, with difficulty, increasingly so, of course. Now, it should be remembered that Aleppo is a major industrial powerhouse. Mm-hmm. And in the surrounding area, there's very fertile agricultural lands. And farming life continued despite the war. While I was there in the countryside around Aleppo, you had actually a potato harvest going on. I distinctly remember seeing helicopter gunships and then, you know, trucks trundling past with freshly harvested potatoes coming from the fields. I remember seeing this kind of thing in Bosnia, where farmers would harvest at night so that the snipers couldn't see them. Farmers have a way of carrying on no matter what, and people do when they need to. Now, if there's a significant uptick in violence in the area where they are, they will probably take their families into Turkey, and increasing numbers are doing so. But for a large number of people, they continue to try to live as normally as possible. There is, by and large, no schools. The schools are being used, in fact, in the rebel-held areas as either prisons or as their headquarters. So children are at home with their parents. Bread was a real difficulty when I was there. They blamed the regime for that and pointed out that Bashar al-Assad's cousin, who was a man who benefited greatly from the privatizations of the last decade and became a billionaire as a result, controlled Syria's bread, the flour milling and bread supply, and that it had been, in fact, cut off from rebel-held areas. But nonetheless, there were little shops open here and there in the city itself, which surprised me. I actually saw women in a few cases lining up to buy goods, vegetable oil, vegetables, that kind of thing. You know, people in these sorts of circumstances, they don't live on quite as much as we do in the West in a place like Syria. And they can simply hunker down at home and eat less. But things like electricity are clearly very, very difficult now. Children are a major concern. If children get sick, the problem of getting them to hospitals, elderly people, everything is beginning to break down. And across the country, of course, under sanctions and at war for now over a year and a half, the economy is effectively ground to a halt. So we're talking about a nation that's increasingly headed towards this kind of subsistence or survival level form of existence.
And how are civilians of different religious backgrounds interacting with one another? You know, obviously a big part of your piece is Syria is this incredibly diverse country, Sunni, Shia, Alawi. Are civilians from different backgrounds suspicious of one another now? Are neighbors that possibly used to live together, you know, peacefully, nicely, are they now looking behind their backs? Are you not seeing that so much in the civilian communities?
No, you are seeing it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was primarily in a Sunni Muslim town. In addition to being in the city of Aleppo, I was in a Sunni Muslim town where much of the rebellion was based. And, you know, these are ancient communities that have formed over hundreds and hundreds of years. Just 3 or 4 miles away from the one I was in, there was a Kurdish town. My host had heard that the Kurds were trying to make, which had traditionally been neutral, or else co-opted by the regime. That at least was how the Free Syrian Army and the rebels saw them, mm-hmm. were making movements towards them. He made an appointment for us to go and meet the local Kurdish politician. When we drove into that town, gunmen pulled their weapons on us, and when they heard I was American, said angrily that they didn't want Americans there and to leave. And we left with a certain amount of tension. We thought they might open fire. Later, that Kurdish politician came and said he was sorry that those people didn't represent his views. But it underscored the incredible tensions that are now boiling up to the surface, as communities that were on the fence before or neutral now have to at least make more explicit their role and their side in the conflict. And in the case of that Kurdish village, previously pro-regime, they were torturously making an approach to the guerrillas, but it wasn't a uniform response, as I saw. I asked my hosts repeatedly about what they felt about Alawites, about Shiites, and about Christians. Mostly there, they were fairly neutral about Christians. They seemed to have a lot of respect for Christians and clearly didn't want to see a situation in which the Christian community would have to leave. These were not hardline Sunni fundamentalists by and large. Mm-hmm. They respected their Christian neighbors and recognized that they were a valuable part of the mosaic that has traditionally made up Syria. But when it came to the Shiites, the Alawites, they said that's a problem and we don't know what we're going to do about that. And that's because they are seen to be absolutely with the government in a kind of sectarian sense. And so, problems yet to come.
John Lee Anderson, before we go, what can you report to us about the overall state of this conflict? And I ask it in this sense. It's been almost exactly a year since our own President Obama called on Bashar al-Assad to step down. Obviously, he hasn't. Obviously, the war drags on. Are we anywhere near what's, you know, the cliche of the tipping point? Or are we just, is Syria and the people that you're describing in for a much longer conflict?
I'm sorry to say, I think there's going to be a lot more bloodshed. Bashar al-Assad will fight to the end. It could go many, many different ways, but one thing is sure, a lot more people are going to be killed.
And you include civilians in addition to fighters in that?
Oh, yes. Mostly it is civilians being killed now. The 20,000, rough 20,000 mark, I would say, is probably three-quarters civilians, if not more.
New Yorker staff writer John Lee Anderson has been reporting from Aleppo. He recently returned and joined us from London. John Lee, thank you so much for the insights and for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.